And I teach at the Vancouver School of Theology in Vancouver, Canada. And I teach in the areas of New Testament and Early Church. And our theme for this week is Leading the Faithful in the Early Church. And our title for today is Female Leadership in Early Christianity. And this is the third part of a series which has been dealing with patriarchal structures of leadership in earliest Christianity. And in the first hour, we were talking about Paul, and I was showing that Paul adopted, in order to establish his mission, the household, the Greco-Roman household, as the primary locale for his teaching, and that he adopted hierarchical relationships within the household to order his own churches that he founded, that he used the patrons and the heads of households to be leaders of the communities which he established. Then in the second hour, we took a look at Colossians, Ephesians, and the pastoral epistles, that is to say, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus. And I was arguing that the death of Paul presented a crisis for the early church, and that to fill the gap of Paul's absence, these household leaders continued to have central roles of leadership in the community, and that the household rules, which then we find in Colossians and Ephesians, become stabilizing means of controlling the community or establishing order in the community. Then I took a look at the pastoral epistles, and I showed that when heresy or when false teaching comes into the community, or that is, say, what is perceived as false teaching comes into the community, these household rules take on an even greater importance, and now you have rules concerning who should be leader based on a kind of a reformulated household code where the bishop is the person who governs his household well. And then there are all these regulations against women. So a woman then, according to 1 Timothy, is saved by childbearing. Women are to keep silent because of the fall story, because Eve tempted Adam, and so on. So, if you will, that is kind of the dark side of the Christian treatment of women in the early church. Today I want to give a little bit of a more positive assessment, if you will, of how, or give the positive picture of how women functioned as leaders in the early church. How positive I can make that is yet to be seen, and it is an open question, I think, whether the way women have been treated in the early church and the roles that they came to exercise of leadership in the early church isn't itself a function of patriarchy. So I'm going to be going through a fair bit of information here, and what I would like is when you have questions or when you have observations, or when you would like to draw connections between what I'm describing and the contemporary experience of women, just to stop me, and then we'll just move from there. So I'm going to work basically from the first century and end somewhere in the fifth century and onward to describe functions of female leadership in earliest Christianity. Well, those who are here for the first hour will remember that I was describing women as leaders in Paul's own communities. So in Romans 16:1, we have the description of Phoebe, who is described as deaconess of the church of Cenchreae, and who is helper, Paul says, of myself and the whole church. And that word helper, the Greek word there, is patroness, or patron. And so I was arguing that Phoebe was probably a person who had as important a role of leadership as any other kind of patron in the early church, and that she would have been singled out by Paul as somebody who had a central function of administration in the early church. It would be anachronistic to call her this, but perhaps we could describe her as a bishop, in fact. And there are other women also who are mentioned by Paul who have roles of apostleship. In Philippians 4:2, we have two people, Euodia and Syntyche, who apparently are not getting along, but they are called true yoke fellows, pardon the sexism there, two true yoke persons perhaps. And the Philippians are enjoined to help these women, for they have labored side by side with me in the gospel. So these are women who are engaged in a kind of ministry that Paul is engaged in. That is to say, they're helping to build communities. In Acts 18, we have Priscilla or Prisca and Aquila who welcome the church into their household. Both of these people, their husband and wife team, are involved in some kind of trade. And as Paul, they labor with their hands, and then they gather the faithful in their own homes. And this picture, then, is also confirmed by the Gospels. And an important book which talks about women in the early church is a book called In Memory of Her. By Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza. And Schussler Fiorenza really looks at all of the evidence of female leadership in the earliest period of Christianity and argues that in this period women had central positions of leadership and were in fact equal to men. And I think that we can see that, and as Schussler Fiorenza points out, we can see that in the Gospels. In John's Gospel, who is the first person to be a witness of Jesus' resurrection? Right, Mary. And the women in all of the Gospels have central roles of proclamation, if you will, of the resurrection of Jesus. So we have then in Luke 24:10, for example, besides Mary, we have Joanna, Mary, and the mother of James who are mentioned. So that, according to Schussler Fiorenza, in any case, this is testimony to central positions of women who were witnesses of the resurrection in the earliest Christian communities. That then changes, as I've already said, in the pastoral epistles in Timothy and Titus, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus, perhaps written around 90 AD, where women then are relegated to be domestics. That is to say, they are to conform to the traditional Greco-Roman values of what a woman is to do and not to do. Women are to be seen and not heard, and for all intents and purposes, women are to be confined to the silence and the privacy of the household, the domestic setting. So where then, after the pastorals, where then female leadership survives in any important form, I would say, is in heretical movements. That is to say, movements which are seen as not legitimate by what is emerging as a kind of mainstream movement within Christianity. And in the second century now, we have a wide variety of movements, Christian movements, which trace their origins back to Jesus' teaching, and which are competing with each other and contending against one another. And these often are a mixture of Judaism, Greek philosophy, and New Testament writings and teachings. And I want to describe for you a couple of them, and without getting into the details of their teaching, which would lead us too far afield, just to give you an idea of some of the roles that women had in these movements. One movement was a movement which is broadly classified as the Gnostic movement, and within Gnosticism there were a whole variety of Gnosticisms, if you will, so we're really using a kind of abstraction when we talk about the Gnostics. And the Gnostics basically argued that there was that the material world was created by a lesser god, and that there was a spiritual kind of higher order which was created by a higher god. The creator god was the god of the Old Testament. The higher god is the god which Jesus represents and Jesus came to reveal. And then there are a whole series of Gnostic writings. And within these writings, women emerge as having central positions of authority. So one important treatise of the Gnostics is a book called The Gospel of Mary. And here in this gospel, as typically in other Gnostic writings, we have a revelation given to one of the apostles. But in this case, the revelation is given to Mary Magdalene. Why do you suppose Mary Magdalene? Why do you think a revelation would be given to her? Remember from John's Gospel?
Supposedly, in John's Gospel, wasn't she a prostitute?
But more importantly, at the end of John's Gospel, it's Mary who discovers the risen Christ. So then she's going to be singled out as a figure now who receives the revelation of Jesus, the true kind of, the true message of Jesus' ministry, if you will. So we have Mary Magdalene in the Gospel of Mary, who is given a special revelation by Jesus, and then she's urged to teach it to other disciples and to other male disciples. And so then this is perhaps some indication, although the evidence can be interpreted in various ways, that there were women who had some importance, some important tasks of leadership in the community. But perhaps clearer, or certainly clearer, is another movement called the Montanist movement. And the Montanists were a group who flourished in the second century in what is now Turkey, in central Turkey. And the Montanists believed that that the end of the world was imminent, and they lived in a kind of expectation of a speedy outpouring of the Holy Spirit on the church. And the first manifestation of this was that there were the presence of prophets and female prophets, male prophets and female prophets, who claimed to be filled with the Holy Spirit, who were appearing in their own churches. And they would give apocalyptic revelations, that is to say, revelations about the end of the world, saying that that the end was to come very, very soon. And one of the central female prophets in this movement was a woman called Priscilla. We don't know a lot about Priscilla, but those people who were opposed to the Montanists have retained for us fragments of her own prophecies. So this movement was suppressed and the writings were destroyed, but those who were opposed to the movement then preserved some of their writings for us. And so there are some fragments of her prophecies which I would like to read to you. So this is one description which is described, which says, "In a vision," this is Priscilla speaking, "in a vision, Christ came to me in the form of a woman, in a bright garment, endowed me with wisdom, and revealed to me that this place is holy, and it is here that Jerusalem is to descend from heaven." So what she's referring to there is a place in central, what's now central Turkey, called Perpazua, which was the place then where the new Jerusalem was to be established. So Jesus, interestingly here, appears to her in the form of a woman, right, and then gives her this revelation. Why in the form of a woman? Well, in the ancient world, one of the figures who transmitted revelations was a mythical female figure called a Sibyl. So perhaps Christ here is being built on the metaphor of the Sibyl, who comes and gives this revelation. Similarly then, there is an interesting reversal of the creation story which occurs amongst the Montanists. If you remember from 1 Timothy, the silencing of women is justified on the basis of the creation story. Eve, the temptress, if you will, causes Adam to fall, and so then she is to be silent. But these people read this creation story in a very different way. They said that, yes, certainly man is created first, if you will, or Adam was created first, but they then say that Eve had a central importance in creation because she was the one that first ate of the tree of knowledge. And the knowledge here is not interpreted as something negative, but as something positive. So Eve then, or woman, has a more important role then as being a receptacle or an instrument of revelation to impart knowledge to the rest of the community. So then we can have the same creation story interpreted different ways by various groups. Okay, so now knowledge, Eve then becomes a transmitter of knowledge. Now, one anti-Montanist writer argued that the Montanists had female bishops and they had female leaders because of references in the Old and New Testaments to female prophets who became leaders. or they recall Acts 21, verse 9, where Philip is described as having four daughters who prophesied. So this movement then goes back into the Old Testament and the New Testament and finds female authorities for their own practices. There's another female prophet named Maximilla who speaks of coming future wars and revolutions, so kind of apocalyptic doom. Now, the Montanists weren't condemned by the early church as heretics, although they were rejected as sort of being a outlandish, bizarre kind of movement. So they were never regarded as being doctrinally unorthodox, but their practice was seen as unacceptable. And there is one early Christian writer who becomes very important for the development of Christian theology, whose name is Tertullian. And Tertullian, in his later life, became a Montanist himself. And he gives an interesting description of the role of these Montanist female prophets in churches. He says that in his own church, people meet and they hear the male bishop deliver the homily and celebrate the Eucharist. And when everybody goes home, some people stay after service and they go to the back of the church where there is a prophetess or a female prophet who then tells of the revelations and the visions and so on that she's been given. And then she imparts these things to the faithful of the community. And this then serves to uplift the community and to instruct the community. Okay, so within then this broader kind of male-dominated setting, there is a place then, according to Tertullian, for these female prophets. They function, though, not in terms of upfront leadership, but as the setting indicates, very much at the back of the church. And so you can imagine that these sorts of things would be seen as somewhat suspicious. And so the movement is rejected, though again, not judged as heretical. Are there any questions or observations or at this point, where we go on? Yes?
What you're calling marginal movements, marginalized because the male bishopric chose to marginalize them? In other words, could they have become the mainstream, except that, were it not for the fact that the men taking over leadership positions?
Yes, they're very much marginalized because the tradition is the ownership of the tradition is being handed over to men, and also because in this period the pastoral epistles are canonical. Okay, so you have the authority of Scripture now saying that women are to be silent in the church, and so on and so forth. So that means then that as these writings gain more and more authority in the early church, that these women leaders are going to be suppressed, or they're going to have to exercise their leadership in different forms. It's going to have to emerge and be justified in different ways then.
You're driven underground by the patriarchy.
Right, yeah. And we'll be talking a little bit later, and that's an interesting kind of metaphor to keep in mind. Even when they do emerge, do they continue to be driven underground in important ways? Yeah. Other questions or observations? Yes?
It strikes me that there's that the role that the women are taking somewhat as prophets or prophetesses, people who kind of connect with the spirit. It's a little bit like what was going on in the 1600s with the women, only at that time they were being accused of being witches. You know, during Salem and Joan of Arc herself and
right.
Some of the other people, but it's the same line of business.
Yeah, sure. So it's very much a suspicion, if you will. And the grounds of this suspicion, again, I think, can be located in the effect that a writing has, or a series of writing has, on the development of quote, Christian culture. Right? So that these things then become highly suspicious, these manifestations. But it's interesting that Tertullian, still at the end of the 2nd century and the beginning of the 3rd century, can regard these things as somewhat more positive. And believe me when I say, we don't have time to recount his theology, but he is anything but a kind of equal rights amendment proponent. He's extremely patriarchal in his other writings. So it's really quite astonishing that he should welcome this sort of thing. In other words, it says that he's understanding the spiritual phenomenon in terms other than, or he's seeing these, somehow he's seeing the import of these women, or he's able to recognize it because of another set of theological criteria that he shares. Anything else? Let's take a look now at the way that female leadership emerges in Orthodox communities, because women do demonstrate important tasks of leadership from the first century onward, the pastoral epistles notwithstanding. So in the Orthodox communities, the way then that females enjoy tasks of leadership is through two means, basically, firstly by exercising their leadership as deaconesses, and then by exercising leadership as widows, or a group in the church called widows. Now, the reason why women emerge as having important tasks of leadership in Orthodox communities is because men are troubled by having to go into households and minister to women. So if you will, we have a little bit more patriarchy here. Again, there's a concern that they don't want to be tempted, right? Or on the other hand, they don't want hostile outsiders to see male bishops going into the homes of Christian women. And maybe you might have a Christian woman who is the wife of a pagan, and it would be somewhat uncomfortable to have a male bishop go and visit a pagan's wife to minister to her. So then you establish women, or you appoint women to go ahead and do that. So they would visit then sick women in homes. They might anoint women at baptism, because in this period people were baptized in the nude. They distribute charity to poor women. And then sometimes they would even teach the recently baptized about the Christian faith. So from sometime between the years 200 and 250, we have a consecration prayer for a deaconess that goes like this, and listen to how female leadership is justified. It goes like this. O eternal God, the creator of man and of woman, who replenished with the spirit of Miriam and Deborah and Anna and Huldah, look now upon this your servant, who is to be appointed to the office of a deaconess, and grant her your Holy Spirit. So again, you look back into the tradition to find examples of female leaders, and you justify the presence of female leaders in your community on the basis of what has happened in history. The last part of that little prayer says, who is to be appointed to the office of a deaconess, and grant her your Holy Spirit. Now, this is a little bit Jesuitical, perhaps, but notice the word there isn't ordained. The word is appointed. And in fact, these early writers want to make a strong distinction between saying, yes, you can appoint females to be leaders, but you can't ordain them to be leaders. Ordination is something which is given to men, but appointment can be something which is given to other orders of ministry. Ordination then seems to imply some kind of setting aside for Eucharistic celebration. So you can ordain a priest or you can ordain a bishop, but you can only appoint a deaconess. This is similarly with widows. Now, the widows, and we encountered them the other day in 1 Timothy, where Timothy says, let only a woman who is over 60 years of age be enrolled as a widow, and then let the younger widows remarry, because when they become widows, after a while, they grow lax in their faith, and they grow wanton with impure desire, and so on. But it seems that as time went on, we would have had younger widows in the community. And the important task of widows was based on all of those promises in the Old Testament, where God looks with favor upon the widow and the orphan, and so on. So the prayer of the widow, that's your experience. So the prayer of the widow then for the church is very important because God looks with favor upon the widows. So the task then of the widow in the early church is one of prayer, to pray for the church. And they're set aside to do that. And again, you become appointed into the order of widows. There's a kind of a ritual that you go through. In the course of time, this order of widows disappears, and what takes its place, or what takes the place of the order of widows, is the presence of nuns. And we're going to be talking a little bit about the development of nuns now as we go on. So is there any question about widows and virgins?
That order of widows, is that in any way similar to the widows in the temple, like Anna? Spend their time in the temple praying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. That would very much be seen as the ideal. I mean, in other words, they would be seen as the model for true widowhood. Right. So again, we have the position of leadership determined to a large degree by a kind of a patriarchy, if you will, or a patriarchal kind of society. Right? Your role of leadership is defined by your marital status, or the absence of a husband.
How is it that the young women who had never been married in the first place were also called widows? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out what the classification is there, because I think that in the New Testament there are so many distinctions between women who are left without a husband after being married for whatever reason, and right. Those who had never been married.
Right. Because widows are continent. I think that the thing that links them two together is the issue of continence. Okay, so the lack of sexual relations. In heretical, or what came to be regarded as suspect, second century literature, women who leave their husbands talk about themselves or describe themselves as living as though they were widows, or in other words, living as though their husbands were dead. So their husbands are still living, if you will, but they take on a life of sexual renunciation and live as though their husbands were dead, or even live as though, you know, the world is dead. Right? So their sexual continence symbolizes then a new kind of order. So I think that the thing which links a woman who's never been married and a widow is the issue of sexual continence. Okay. Yes?
Considering that the lifespan wasn't very long, there shouldn't be very many widows left.
That's a good point. Somebody brought that up the other day. And that would mean that in First Timothy, when it says that let only women who are over 60 years of age be enrolled as widows, this is a pretty good way of kind of wiping out the whole order of widows in the community.
Well, if you remember, men usually marry women that are much younger. So mm-hmm. Men might die at 60 and leave a 20-year-old widow.
Right. Right. Yeah. So let's go on now to talk about two other roles of women which emerge in the early church. And I want to talk now about martyrs and ascetics. Martyrs and ascetics. Now, within the mainstream of the Christian faith, women enjoyed prominence in two ways from the second century onward, at least from the second century onward. The first one was through martyrdom. Like their male counterparts, those who died for the faith were seen as being venerable and as being honored. And there are a series of stories which come to us from the 3rd century about females who die for the faith. People who are imprisoned for their faith, and in particular women, again, who enjoy special spiritual powers while in prison. And they then instruct the faithful from their position in prison. So one of them is a woman named Perpetua, or Perpetua. And we have a recounting of her story for martyrdom. Now, the story goes that Perpetua has just given birth to a son, and just after she gave birth, she has been arrested, and now she's thrown in prison. And while she is in prison, she's breastfeeding her son. And then her father comes to her and tries to urge her to renounce the faith for the sake of her son, because who's going to take care of her son and so on. But nonetheless, she remains faithful to Christ and simply gives her son away for somebody else to care for. Her husband tries to talk her out of her Christian faith, but similarly she says, you know, I'm not to be faithful to God primarily. And then after she's renounced her husband and her own father and her son, she has a series of prophetic visions. And then in one of these, she has a vision, interestingly, of male clergy, male bishops, falling before her feet and seeking a blessing. So we have here an interesting image of a kind of a patriarchy, which is reversed through this act of martyrdom. So you have this woman who's in prison, and she has a higher kind of spiritual status, if you will, than this secular authority of these, or this more secular sacred authority of these clergy. But then there's another more intriguing reference to her martyrdom, where she has a vision of herself in the arena where she's going to be martyred. And this is how the writer of her martyrdom describes what happens in this vision. She sees this: "My clothes were stripped off, and suddenly I was a man. And then the lions come and devour her." So then as the vision progresses, she struggles against this wild beast. And this can perhaps be explained by the fact that the writer is wanting to stress the manly qualities of her virtue. That is to say, courage, strength, and so on. So even in the midst of this celebration of a female martyr, you have her turning into a man in order to have a successful martyrdom. Okay. So this is perhaps a more sort of positive picture of a form of spiritual female leadership, but it also there's also an interest to invest some male elements in this story. And I'll be talking a little bit more about that now when I describe ascetic Christians and the way that sexuality was interpreted in the early church. So this picture of a woman turning into a man introduces us to Greco-Roman anthropology, or the understanding of the human person. In the early church, after the period of persecution in the 4th and 5th centuries, women have central positions of authority as ascetics, that is to say, people who retreat into monasteries or people who are hermits who simply live in seclusion and live lives of devotion in seclusion. And there is the belief from the 2nd century onward that the goal of the Christian life is to master the self. And in particular, that part of the self you're to master is the self with all of its bodily desires and its drives. There is the belief here that what is made in the image of God is the mind. Okay, so when in Genesis it says that humankind is made in the image of God, what is primarily being asserted here is the reasoning faculty. And it so happens now that the Greek word for mind is nous, and for reason is logos, and these are masculine nouns. Hebrew has masculine and feminine nouns. Okay, so when these writers come to contemplate the self, they now think that half of you is made up of a male principle, that is to say, the mind, or the logos. And it is that male aspect of you which is now in the image of God. But then there's another part of us all, which the Christian is to control, which I just described, as desire. Now, the Greek word for desire is orexis, and similarly, another aspect here that the mind is to control is the flesh, which in Greek is sarx, and both of these are feminine nouns. So this means now that we're made up of a male element and a female element. The male element now is mind, logos. The female element in us is orexis, desire, or sarx, flesh. So the male is to dominate and control the female. Okay, so you have a kind of a hierarchy in yourself, which you are to establish and to preserve through the practice of self-discipline. So the rational nature, the male nature, is to control the desiring, and also that is described as an irrational nature or a female kind of principle. So women then become very, very important in the stories of asceticism, and they become heroes in this whole life. Because what can be more dramatic, if you will, than a woman who is able to control female faculties? Right? So these women become heroes in this culture. So we have desert Christians, and the desert Christians, this was a movement which took off in the middle of the 3rd century, primarily in Egypt, and we have about 20,000 females who go off to live lives of seclusion in the Egyptian desert. And there's a whole genre of literature which is extraordinarily interesting, which describes harlots or prostitutes who become virgins in the desert. So harlotry, of course, refers to sort of sexuality gone wild, and now a harlot who becomes a virgin becomes a dramatic reenactment of the role of mind controlling desire. Okay, so the ascetic nun then, or the continent nun, becomes a very heroic figure in this kind of this kind of anthropology. So we have here a very different way of construing sexuality and construing the second and construing the human person as compared with the 20th century model. How would we regard this kind of model around the 20th century? How would our own model of sexuality differ here from this, do you think? It's quite a different way, isn't it? Our own model of sexuality. Yes?
Except those churches, this is the first time I've heard of this in history. Those churches that when a couple goes to the pastor to be married, and the pastor says, "Are you living together?" And they say yes, and then in some churches, they must enter into a process of re-virginization, which almost sounds strange.
Interesting. Describe that process more.
Yeah. Well, it's simply abstinence, sexual abstinence.
Right.
And,
So some pastors are sort of enjoining.
This is in more fundamentalist churches.
Continent.
Yeah.
Right. Not only, I go to Catholic Bishop University, and one of our campus pastors does that as part of the premarital counseling.
Oh.
If the people are engaged and are either living together, especially after the abstinence until they can't.
Now, why would they do that?
He says it's because he wants the marriage to be a change. He wants it to be a definite change in their lifestyle, and if they keep on living together and then get married, there's not a definite break and change in relationship.
So he sees us as a kind of rite of passage and the rite of passage becomes more of a dramatic rite, if you will, or a more remarkable rite if there's some sexual element connected with it.
Mm-hmm. That's how it is.
Yeah, I've never heard that before. Yes.
Well, this is changing a little bit, but what was interesting to me when you were talking about the feminine woman, the names for that being desire and so on, that I had just done some reading about the early Puritans, and that was definitely their philosophy, was that the man was pure and the woman was the one who did all the evil things in terms of sexuality. And so if a man erred, it was the woman's fault. I mean, she had led him on, so to speak. And that, and even to the statements of knowing that women really were basically evil, and that man had control, he had to control her because otherwise she would go out of control. And I was shocked. I mean, I knew the Puritans were a little warped, but it was a book called Massachusetts, and I just went down and
I don't know enough about Puritan cosmology, but I don't know if anybody does know about how Puritans construed the universe, and whether there was any sense of male faculties and female faculties, where it would be necessary then to, you see, in this model, it's a very cosmic one, right? And the human person represents a kind of a cosmic order where male controls female. So we're grounded in cosmology here. So it would be really interesting then to know more about the Puritans.
Yeah, I was just curious in my own mind is if this is where they actually got it from, because it went into all areas and aspects of their living then. Women were really put down in everything.
Right.
Yeah. Well, doesn't that go back to the old biblical story where the woman was stoned for harlotry and the man had to pay a fine?
Yeah, right. Yeah, we had that story recounted for us last night.
Well, that's still today.
Yes. Not stoned physically, perhaps, but in other ways. Punished socially.
Women are prostitutes, are put in jail, and the man who
we
get the cars.
Say that you have a male pastor, and in many churches women gather, I've seen women gather around for knowledge and that type of thing. Now in a church where there's a female pastor, do the men gather around her for knowledge?
Good question.
I mean, I'd like to have an answer to that from someone who has a female pastor.
Any observations on that one? I know I've heard lots of people say they could never respect a female pastor the way they could a male pastor.
Yeah, it's usually females
then.
Right,
that's right. Yeah. I'm intrigued by that wonderful term you coined of re-virginization.
I didn't coin it.
You didn't coin it.
No, that's what they call it.
That's what they call it, the re-virginization, because in many ways, this is what these ascetics were struggling for. They were struggling to restore the virgin life, that is to say, the life of innocence, the life which was free from desire. So you have these women then who are imposing on themselves this model of virginity as a sign now that they are in the image of this more kind of masculine God. So it's from a 20th century perspective anyway, it's a kind of total alienation that's going on.
But theirs was permanent while his was temporary, as far as the virginization. When they went into the monastery, it was a permanent thing.
That's right, yeah, that's right. It was meant to be permanent.
I've heard it referred to lately as a born again virgin.
Okay, so we have these stories of these prostitutes who become virgins, and then this recovered virginity indicates a victory over the self, over the female drives. and that it is a woman who enjoys this victory makes that victory all the more astonishing. So one can imagine then that these stories function as kind of dramatic depictions, in particular for man. Also interesting here is that there were two times the number of female monastics in Egypt than there were male ones. So for some reason it was women who were particularly drawn to this life of asceticism.
Well, it should have been so much easier for the man.
Right.
Right.
And there's another point.
I was just going to say, it just shows that actually women didn't enjoy it as much as men did, even though they were accused of admission. Because they were so willing to go in there. At least they didn't in those days.
We have that is a more kind of extreme form, if you will, of female asceticism, that these women become heroes in the early church. But there's a whole other category of them, and now these are not in the Egyptian desert, but these now are in Rome, or in Italy, in Milan and Rome and in other cities, and these now become domestic monastic women. So we had hermits, and now in the desert, now we have them in the household. And these women arose in the early part of the 4th century and were really flourishing. The movement was really flourishing by the end of the 4th century. And it was comprised primarily of aristocratic women. And we're talking now about the very cream of society. It would be like if Lady Diana, if Princess Diana became a nun. Yeah, that's the sort of thing that we're talking about here. So these aristocratic women renounce all the indices of wealth and status, and they retreat into the household. And they renounce their husbands. Often their husbands become monks, and they become nuns. They stop bathing. They refuse to have sexual relations with their husbands. They are never seen in public, or they only show their face at night. Or they go have their slaves, because they're very wealthy, so they own slaves. They have their slaves go off and do the shopping for them. And they devote themselves to lives of study and prayer. On the other hand, they might become nuns after their spouses die. And these women then form circles within mansions in Rome or on estates on the periphery of Rome, and these become centers of study. And you'll have mothers and daughters becoming nuns together. You'll have fathers who dedicate their daughters to become nuns from the moment they're born. They may live with their relatives, and together they're engaged in these lives of celibacy and these lives of devotion. And the only person who wrote something which has remained for us is a domestic nun whose name was Proba. And Proba was one of the wealthiest women in Rome in the 4th century, and she wrote a poem called the Cento. I guess in Italian Latin it would be the Cento, which is basically a hundred lines or a hundred verses based on the life of Christ, which is unfortunately exceedingly boring to read. But it is the only thing which has survived from this early period written by a woman. That is to say, from this circle. Other women journeyed off to Jerusalem, where they founded monasteries and centers of learning. Some of them, one woman's name was Marcella. Marcella was, again, a very influential Roman woman who rocked the Roman society when she decided to become a virgin. This was like an absolute scandal for Roman society. But she became very learned in Hebrew, and one church father named Jerome, who is regarded as one of the major fathers of the church, one of the four, one of the major ones, he used to write to her to ask for advice on how to translate Hebrew. So we see her then as being very, very scholarly and very, very knowledgeable, and she gathers this community of women around her in Jerusalem. And these monasteries now become centers of learning. Others of these women went on pilgrimages, and one of them, whose name is Egeria, traveled all over the ancient world, going up Mount Sinai, and seeing churches on Mount Sinai, or going to Jerusalem and seeing the true fragments of the cross and so on. And it's a, and her trap, and then she formulates a travel narrative, which is a kind of a tour guide in many ways, a tour handbook to the holy sites of the ancient world. The fact that this woman can travel in the ancient world is really something, given the culture. Women typically didn't travel alone, but here we have Egeria who. Or women didn't travel without men, but here we have this woman who travels with these other women. Yes?
About what year was she?
She was in the 4th century.
About the same time as, was it Constantine's mother who went to the Holy Land and
That's
looked
right.
at all the holy sites?
That's right. This was after that. So Egeria goes along and she sees all the things like Constantine's mother did or Constantine's mother discovered. Right, but again, Constantine's mother is functioning in a slightly different role as a member of the imperial family and as a patron of the church. So she has more of an imperial administrative kind of function here. Whereas Egeria is a person of no status at all, if you will, who's traveling around, which makes her journey then more astonishing.
What was the status of these women in the church? I mean, you were talking about the hierarchy of the Roman household. Well, if they were outside the household, do they have status?
Well, now they have a status which is derived, again, on male terms, okay? Because, remember I was talking about the virgin as, the female virgin as being a kind of a hero. Because if desire and flesh are sort of female elements, right, that a woman controls them, means now that it's quite something when a woman enters into a life of virginity. So they become remarkable centers of spiritual authority because they're able to do this. They become models of heroism for these men. So this is how then they can legitimate their, or this is, if you will, the source of their authority is in their continence in many ways. Yes?
But they
always
had
a
bishop over them, didn't they?
Yes.
I mean, I haven't read. They always had a man who was over the.
That's right.
So they still were a little lower in the hierarchy.
Oh yes, well not just a little lower, a lot lower. Yeah. So, yeah. So for example, though Jerome can ask Marcella for advice, Marcella still very much sees Jerome as her spiritual master. Jerome himself got into a lot of trouble because. He was the master of all these women, or the spiritual authority over all these women in Rome. And he was really encouraging these women to enter into lives of continence and devotion and seclusion and so on. Marcella had a daughter named Blastilla, and Blastilla, after her husband died, took on this life of sexual of renunciation and asceticism and so on, and fasted and engaged in asceticism so severely that she actually killed herself. This caused a tremendous scandal in Rome, and Jerome was basically kicked out of the city with all of his women with him. And there was a lot of, you know, the pagans, because paganism, or let's say non-Christian philosophical movements, were still, had an important role to play amongst the educated elite of Roman society. They looked very wryly upon Jerome and his women. And, you know, there's all sorts of innuendo concerning him and what was actually going on in these domestic monasteries and so on and so forth. but we still very much have a man who is in control of these women. So these women then become biblical scholars, they travel, they pursue scholarship, they form communities of women, they govern communities of women, but again, they're not permitted to be bishops. And this is basically the pattern which remains in place, and obviously we can take a look at different epochs and so on, and look at other forms of female leadership. But this remains the pattern up until our own century, where now women do have a role, a more priestly role to play. Now, women can be pastors, and in our own Lutheran church, let's say in the ELCA, a woman has just become bishop. So there's been a real movement, if you will. And I think that one of the reasons why this movement has arisen is because there's a completely different cultural understanding, or what's developing as a different cultural understanding of the role of women in society. Any questions or observations?
Who has just become bishop in the ELCA?
Pardon me?
Who has just become bishop in the ELCA?
Is it in South Wisconsin?
April
Larson.
She was in our area, and she's the first Lutheran bishop. She was an assistant bishop in our area in Minnesota, and she now has become
in Wisconsin.
In southern Wisconsin, a small area, and everyone is pulling for her.
Right, and then there's one that became a bishop in Germany. So she was the first one just a few weeks before.
This is the first U.S.
Right, that's right. So there's a kind of a revolution that's going on here. Yeah. Yes?
I guess I don't know if I'm sort of skeptical or something, but tell me about the numbers of some of these groups. Are these just little pockets? I mean, there's lots of, even today, there's little pockets of this and that, and somebody could write it down and become part of history perhaps, but it's not significant and it doesn't necessarily play an important historical part. How significant are these people? I haven't heard of most of them.
Right. Well, they're not numerous, but if we put them in their own cultural context, their influence far outweighed their numbers, because if you have somebody like Princess Diana becoming a nun, right, that says a lot more, or that's a lot more known than if you become one, for example, that body, if body becomes one. So this means then that their stories are written up, and their stories then are passed on to other people who read them. So the numerical strength then is not really an indication of the influence that they have on society, I would say. And certainly as time goes on after the period that I've talked about, more and more women enter into this certain monastic profession. So yes, it's just pockets, but those pockets have an important influence on people's thinking and the way women view themselves and interpret their own identities.
This continued for a number of centuries, did it not? This idea of aesthetics and going off and
that's right.
Into England. And
that's right, yeah. And I know that there are male models or male ascetics, male hermits, but I don't really know about female ones in the 20th century.
One was Judith of something other. There's a lot, she's done a lot, she did a lot of writing. Julian of Norwich,
right. Okay. Yeah. So she's an English hermit in the high Middle Ages, that's right. Any other points? Well, I guess I'll close the chapter on female leaders in the early church. Thank you for bearing with this survey and a lot of information, but hopefully you come away with some sense of where women were in these first 4 centuries. So thank you.
That's nice. Thank you.